Of all of the concepts to come out of modern physics, or even of all of science, perhaps none have captured our imagination as much as black holes. From Star Trek to Interstellar, they are a staple of science fiction. Dozens of popular books have been written about these strange and fascinating objects, by authors ranging from Kip Thorne and Stephen Hawking to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Black holes are, in fact, a direct consequence of Einstein's theory of general relativity. But Einstein himself never realized or accepted this fact. In this lecture, we'll talk about black holes, what they are, how they were discovered, and how they form in our universe. We'll also talk about why Einstein resisted the possibilities that black holes actually exist. In the paper that Einstein wrote in 1915, introducing the theory of general relativity, he used the field equations of his theory to make a number of different predictions. Most notably, these predictions included Einstein's calculation of Mercury's orbit, which agreed very well with observations, while the equations of Newtonian gravity famously did not. As I mentioned in the last lecture, Einstein's field equations are notoriously difficult to manipulate, even for physicists who are expert in relativity. Technically speaking, this is because these equations are nonlinear, which means that when you change one input, you end up changing many other things as well. Einstein himself originally thought that these equations could not be solved exactly. Instead, he found mathematical techniques to identify approximate solutions. Today, physicists often employ the help of powerful computers to solve these ruthlessly formidable equations. It turns out, however, that in some special and simple cases, exact solutions to Einstein's field equations do exist. The first person to find one of these exact solutions wasn't Einstein himself, or even another leading scientist from among the German universities that general relativity was first widely disseminated to. Instead, the first exact solution came from a German lieutenant fighting in the trenches of the Russian front of World War I. This lieutenant was an astronomer and mathematician named Karl Schwarzschild. When World War I broke out in 1914, Schwarzschild was the director of the Astrophysical Observatory in Potsdam. Thinking of himself as a German patriot, Schwarzschild volunteered for military service shortly after hostilities began, despite being 41 years old at the time. Over the next several months, he put his mathematical abilities to use for the German army, calculating the trajectories of artillery shells, and in the process, seeing action in France, Belgium, and Russia. While in the trenches of the Eastern Front, Schwarzschild somehow got his hands on a copy of the most recent issue of the Proceedings of the Royal Prussian Academy of Sciences, which included a brief account by Einstein describing his new theory of general relativity. From the contents of this article, Schwarzschild became one of the first physicists to learn to skillfully manipulate the equations of Einstein's new theory. In his exploration of general relativity, Schwarzschild focused on an extremely simple, albeit physically important, case. He imagined a situation with a spherical mass, like a perfectly round star or planet. This wasn't rotating or otherwise changing. In this simple case, Schwarzschild calculated the effects of gravity using Einstein's field equations. Far away from the spherical mass, Schwarzschild found that gravity acts the same way that Isaac Newton predicted that it would two centuries before. But as you move in closer to the spherical mass, Schwarzschild's solution begins to depart from the Newtonian prediction. Among other things, Schwarzschild's solution showed that Einstein's theory could perfectly explain the long-standing discrepancy observed by the orbit of Mercury. By finding the exact solution for Mercury's orbit rather than Einstein's approximate solution, Schwarzschild demonstrated with much greater rigor that observations of Mercury favored general relativity over Newtonian gravity. In December of 1915, Schwarzschild wrote a letter to Einstein describing the solution that he had discovered to the field equations. The next month, Einstein wrote back to Schwarzschild and shortly thereafter presented the new solution at a meeting of the Prussian Academy. Einstein was apparently very pleased, albeit surprised, that such a simple and exact solution could be found. Einstein had previously thought that the nonlinearity of his field equations would make it impossible to find any exact solutions. But upon examining Schwarzschild's letter, Einstein happily conceded that he was mistaken, at least in this very special case. Over the next few months, Schwarzschild wrote two papers on general relativity, which, among other things, detailed his important and exact solution to the field equations. Despite the ongoing hardships of war, Schwarzschild was at the peak of his scientific skills and achievements. That makes it all the more tragic that in March of 1916, Schwarzschild came down with a rare skin disease that caused his immune system to attack his own skin cells, leading to painful blisterings and other symptoms. 2 months later, Schwarzschild died, never to see the legacy of his work. The Schwarzschild solution to the field equations is famous today not because it was the first exact solution of general relativity, or because it predicts the orbit of Mercury correctly. It is most often talked about today because of some of the other interesting and bizarre predictions that it makes. According to Schwarzschild's solution, if you could somehow compress enough mass into a small enough volume, the geometry of the surrounding space would go haywire, and space-time itself would become infinitely curved. The radius around an object at which this space-time becomes infinitely curved is known as the Schwarzschild radius, and it's proportional to the mass of an object. For example, if the mass of the entire Sun were compressed from its current radius of about 430,000 miles into a radius of only 1.9 miles, the space around it would become infinitely curved. For an object with the mass of the Earth, the Schwarzschild radius is about a third of an inch. This infinite curvature would prevent anything, even including light, from ever passing through the Schwarzschild radius. To a stationary observer viewing such an object from the outside, the infinite curvature of space means that it would take an infinitely long time for anything to pass through the Schwarzschild radius. And therefore, nothing can ever escape from or reach such an object. Decades later, physicists would begin to call these objects by the name we use today, black holes. At the time, Einstein seemed to not give much thought to the possibility that such exotic objects might exist. He instead focused on much more pragmatic issues, such as comparing the predictions of the Schwarzschild solution to the observations of Mercury's orbit. And at the time, there were good reasons for one to be skeptical that black holes really exist. For one thing, even if a black hole would hypothetically form if there were enough mass compressed into a small enough volume of space, this doesn't mean that it has necessarily ever happened. Even if there were a law of physics that said that a unicorn is born every time that the Queen of England does a jig on the North Pole, this wouldn't mean that there are any unicorns in our universe today. Maybe a black hole could in principle be formed, but in practice, maybe it never has actually formed. Furthermore, most physicists at the time thought that there would likely be things that would prevent a black hole from forming, even in principle. After all, there was a lot of uncharted territory between the kind of stars that had been observed and the kind of conditions that could potentially lead to the formation of a black hole. There could very well have been new laws of physics yet to be discovered that would somehow prevent black holes from ever forming in the real world. It was far from obvious at the time that black holes did or even could exist. In any case, Einstein in 1916 was not alone in doubting that black holes were real. At the time of Carl Schwarzschild's death, he left us with a number of very intriguing and unanswered questions. Could black holes exist, even hypothetically? If so, do they actually exist in our universe? And if they do, how do they form? The answers to these questions would gradually reveal themselves to us over the decades that followed. As it turns out, in order to understand the formation of black holes, we first need to understand the inner workings and evolution of stars. During the period of time that Einstein's theory of general relativity was being developed, scientists knew very little about how stars evolved, or even how they were powered. In fact, the question of where the sun gets the energy needed to produce its sunlight had been stubbornly unanswered for a very long time. It was really an embarrassment for science. Ordinary ways of storing and releasing energy just didn't come close to account for the huge quantity of energy that had been released by the sun over its lifetime. For example, imagine that the sun generated its energy through chemical processes, like the way that my car extracts energy from fossil fuels, or that our bodies extract energy from food. Even if the entire mass of the sun, all 2 million trillion trillion kilograms of it, was made up of gasoline, at the current output of sunlight, the sun would run out of fuel in about 7,000 years. To account for the quantity of energy that had been released by the sun over the past 4.6 billion years, there had to be a fuel that was at least hundreds of thousands of times more efficient. Throughout the 1800s, many physicists thought that the sun was powered by its gradual gravitational collapse. As gravity compressed the sun, they argued, the gravitational potential energy could be transformed into heat and sunlight. The most optimistic estimates, however, suggested that this might be able to generate enough energy to power the sun for a few tens of millions of years. In 1800, this seemed plausible. Geologists didn't know much yet about how old the sun or the Earth were. But by 1900, it was entirely clear that the Earth was billions and not only millions of years old. Gravity could not be the primary energy source of the sun. With the introduction of the theory of relativity, however, there appeared another possibility for the source of the sun's energy. According to Einstein's most famous equation, E equals mc squared, mass could at least in principle be transformed into energy, and at a very generous exchange rate. A single gram of matter contains 90 trillion joules of energy, the equivalent of more than 20,000 tons of TNT. If there was some process going on in the sun that was able to convert even a very small amount of the sun's mass into energy, that process could plausibly provide enough energy to power the sun for tens of billions of years. By around 1920 or so, physicists had begun to recognize that the most likely way that stars could convert their mass into energy was through the process known as nuclear fusion. In particular, the English astronomer and physicist Arthur Eddington proposed that stars like the sun might generate their energy through the gradual transformation of hydrogen into helium nuclei. This process destroys a small fraction of the star's mass and steadily releases a great deal of energy in its place. A few years after making this proposal, Eddington wrote a book entitled The Internal Constitution of Stars. In this book, he describes stars as being in a constant balance between the contracting forces of gravity and the outward pressure from nuclear fusion. This is more or less how we understand stars to work today. In his book, Eddington recognized one particularly interesting consequence of his theory. Whereas gravity will continue to compress a star forever, a star's ability to undergo nuclear fusion will eventually run out once it has exhausted all or at least most of the hydrogen in its core. Once the process of fusion ends in a star, it seems logical that gravity should be expected to compress the star into a much smaller volume. Eddington remained essentially neutral regarding what takes place when a star runs out of its nuclear fuel, remarking only that one could make many fanciful suggestions as to what will actually happen. Although no one knew it yet, astronomers had already found a clue to the mystery of what happens to stars when they run out of nuclear fuel. For years, astronomers had been studying a strange star that they called Sirius B. By studying the orbits of this star and its binary companion star, astronomers had learned that the mass of Sirius B is similar to that of the sun. But the light emitted by this star told astronomers that Sirius B was very different, both much hotter and much more luminous than ordinary stars are. Strangest of all, the density of Sirius B is about a billion times the density of water, wildly more dense than ordinary stars. Sirius B is a tiny star which contains a sun's worth of mass within a volume that is about the size of the Earth. It was unlike any star that anyone had ever seen before. No one understood what it was made of or how it came to be that way. It was the British astrophysicist Ralph Fowler who first offered an answer to the question of the nature of Sirius B. And in doing so, he also provided an answer to Eddington's question of what happens to stars when they run out of nuclear fuel. Fowler argued that when a star could no longer support itself with nuclear fusion, gravity would suddenly compress it into a much smaller volume. The novel element that Fowler introduced came from the new theory of quantum mechanics, which is something we'll talk about in later lectures of the series. According to quantum theory, there seemed to be a minimum size to which matter can be compressed. This leads to a phenomenon called quantum degeneracy pressure, which forces electrons to keep their distance from one another, and thus prevents the matter that makes up a star from becoming compressed into too small of a volume. As it turns out, the minimum size that Fowler calculated for a typical star was similar to the observed size of Sirius B. Sirius B and other stars like it are supported against the force of gravity not by nuclear fusion like ordinary stars, but by the strange effects of quantum mechanics. Stars like this are called white dwarfs. Although Fowler's insights into the nature of white dwarf stars were certainly important, it turns out that his arguments only apply to stars with a relatively modest mass. The scientist who first reached this conclusion is one of my favorite figures in the history of science. He was the young Indian physics student named Subramanian Chandrasekhar. Chandrasekhar grew up in India as part of a wealthy and privileged family. But even given those advantages, his talents were staggering and clearly evident from a young age. Upon finishing college at the age of 19, he was invited to pursue graduate studies at Cambridge and study under Ralph Fowler, who had recently proposed the existence of white dwarf stars. Chandrasekhar was not one to waste time, and he spent the long sea voyage to England reading physics papers, including the paper on white dwarf stars by his soon-to-be advisor, Ralph Fowler. Not only did the 19-year-old Chandrasekhar understand Fowler's paper, he was the first to really recognize its limitations. Fowler's arguments, Chandrasekhar deduced, were valid for medium-sized stars, but they break down for stars that are too massive. For any star with a mass more than about 1.4 times the mass of the Sun, the force of gravity will be strong enough to overcome the quantum degeneracy pressure that supports a white dwarf. Any star that is more massive than this will continue to collapse when it runs out of nuclear fuel, shrinking to a size that's even smaller than a white dwarf. Over the next decade or so, Chandrasekhar, Fowler, Eddington, and others debated back and forth about what happens to massive stars when their nuclear fuel becomes exhausted. But by the end of the 1930s, it had become clear that massive stars collapse well beyond the white dwarf stage, forming something even more dense, called a neutron star. A neutron star is an object that consists almost entirely of neutrons, without the protons or electrons that are found in all forms of ordinary matter. Because it contains no electrically charged particles, this all-neutron matter can be compressed into ridiculously small volumes of space and reach unimaginably high densities. A typical neutron star contains a couple of suns worth of mass confined with a volume the size of a small city, about 7 miles in radius. To put it another way, the density of a neutron star is roughly equivalent to that of the entire Earth if you were to squeeze it into a sphere the width of a football field. But even this isn't the end of the story for the very most massive of stars. For those stars that are more massive than a few times the mass of the Sun, even this all-neutron state isn't stable. The calculations of a number of physicists, including Robert Oppenheimer, who would later become the head of the Manhattan Project, had shown that even a neutron star will collapse if it's heavier than a few times the mass of the Sun. Once this threshold is passed, there is nothing that can prevent a star from collapsing indefinitely. A very massive star, once out of nuclear fuel, will collapse beyond the size of a white dwarf or even a neutron star. Such a star will become a black hole. It was around this time in the debate that Einstein re-injected himself into the discussion. Although astronomers and physicists had learned a lot about stars in the 15 years since the discovery of general relativity, including the likely existence of white dwarfs and neutron stars, Einstein's opinions on the subject had not changed much. In 1939, Einstein wrote his first and only paper about black holes, entitled On a Stationary System with Spherical Symmetry Consisting of Many Gravitating Masses. In this article, he set out to calculate how a large group of particles would behave as they collapsed under the force of gravity. In doing so, he argued that the particles' angular momentum would prevent them from collapsing indefinitely, and that this would prevent a black hole from ever forming. In this, he was completely wrong. Einstein's prejudice that black holes can never exist in nature blinded him from all of the arguments to the contrary and led him to reject one of the most incredible facets of his own theory. Worse still, Einstein's opinion was so highly regarded that many physicists specializing in relativity tended to dismiss all talk of black holes for many years to come. For decades, such objects were almost never even mentioned in the scientific literature. Furthermore, interest in general relativity declined considerably during this period. It wasn't so much that physicists doubted the validity of Einstein's theory, but they hadn't found many practical uses for it. The predictions that general relativity makes are in most cases very similar to the old Newtonian predictions, and there wasn't much that could be done in a laboratory that could test the theory further or explore its implications. But a few years after Einstein's death in 1955, interest in general relativity began to undergo a resurgence. All around the world, small groups of physicists started to actively explore the deeper and more strange implications of Einstein's general theory. One of the key figures in general relativity's resurgence was the young British physicist and mathematician Roger Penrose. Penrose first became interested in relativity while he was an undergraduate at University College London. During this period, however, few physicists actually knew very much about general relativity. So Penrose had little choice but to teach himself this subject, managing to learn general relativity from books and papers instead of from his professors. Penrose then went on to study mathematics at Cambridge, where he earned his PhD, and then carried out research for brief stints at Princeton, London, Syracuse, and the University of Texas at Austin. Austin at the time was a location of one of the few concentrations of physicists who were actively studying general relativity. Among others, Penrose met the physicist Roy Kerr in Austin. Kerr was able to find a solution to Einstein's field equations that is more general and therefore more powerful than Schwarzschild's. In particular, while Schwarzschild's result only describes objects that are stationary, Kerr's solution also allows for the possibility that black holes could be rotating. At the time, few physicists thought that black holes really existed, if they gave any thought to it at all. But in 1965, Penrose made a discovery that would turn that viewpoint on its head. Using mathematics that was very different from anything Einstein had ever used, Penrose was able to rigorously prove that under certain circumstances, a collapsing star would be guaranteed to form a black hole. In particular, if the collapsing star is massive enough, then the formation of a black hole is entirely inevitable. So in January of 1965, Penrose published a short 3-page paper entitled Gravitational Collapse and Space-Time Singularities. Now at the time, Penrose's argument went strongly against the conventional wisdom of the physics community. And there were many who argued, like Einstein had long done, that the complexities of real collapsing stars would prevent them from forming black holes. But Penrose's mathematics was compelling, and over the next few years, the opinions of many physicists were swayed. By the end of the 1960s, it had become a mainstream view that black holes were in fact likely, if not guaranteed, to exist in nature. As more and more physicists became convinced that black holes actually exist, interest began to grow in the ways that these objects might be detected or observed. One of the first scientists to actively work on this question was the Russian physicist Yakov Seldovich. Seldovich was an incredibly prolific and versatile physicist. Over the course of his career, he made major contributions to almost every field of physics and astronomy, including material science, particle physics, relativity, astrophysics, cosmology, and nuclear physics, including work that he did on the Soviet weapons program. In the early 1960s, he proposed that the presence of black holes could be indirectly inferred by studying the motion of other nearby stars. The invisible black hole, he argued, would cause another star within its own solar system to wobble back and forth with a regular period. If you could somehow observe such a wobbling star, you could identify the black hole and even measure its mass. Alternatively, Seldovich argued that under certain circumstances, a black hole could have a dramatic impact on the material surrounding it. All astrophysical bodies attract and accumulate matter through the force of their gravity. But unlike ordinary stars or planets, the matter that falls toward a black hole will be accelerated to nearly the speed of light as it approaches. Furthermore, this infalling material will spiral around the black hole like a fluid running down a drain. Since this material is moving at nearly the speed of light, it is incredibly hot, millions of degrees. Seldovich argued that such systems could release huge amounts of energy and could be observed by astronomers even at very great distances. This brings us to the mystery of the strange astronomical object known as Cygnus X1. Cygnus X1 was first detected by astronomers in 1964, but it was starting in around 1970 that observations of this object began to reveal some of its more bizarre characteristics. This object was observed to release very bright flashes of X-rays, multiple times each second. The short durations of this X-ray light tells us that whatever is making this is not very big by astronomical standards, no more than a fraction of a light second across, or in other words, not much more than about 100,000 kilometers or so. And X-rays are produced only in very hot environments, millions of degrees. In the following year, radio observations in the direction of Cygnus X1 discovered a blue supergiant star. This star, however, is far too big to generate the rapid X-ray flickering that had been observed. In order to produce the observed X-rays, astronomers deduced that a portion of this star's gas was somehow being torn off and then heated to very high temperatures. Later in the same year, other observations began to detect the wobble of the blue supergiant, just as Seldovich had suggested a decade earlier. From the observed wobble, it was clear to astronomers that the nearby object was very massive indeed, far too massive to even be a neutron star. As the quality of the observations continued to improve over the years that followed, it became more and more clear that Cygnus X1 is in fact a black hole. By the late 1970s, most astrophysicists had come to accept this conclusion, as well as the conclusion that black holes indeed exist in our universe. We now know that Cygnus X1 is a black hole about 6,000 light years away from us, and that it's about 15 times as massive as the Sun. At this mass, the Schwarzschild radius of this black hole is about 44 kilometers. Anything within this radius is forever lost from our view. And in this sense, it's lost from our universe itself. In the decades since astronomers determined that Cygnus X1 is a black hole, astronomers and astrophysicists have discovered numerous other black holes in our universe. This includes dozens of black holes that were once thought to be massive stars, similar to Cygnus X1. But in addition, many much larger and more massive black holes have also been discovered. The center of our own Milky Way galaxy, for example, is the host of an enormous black hole, with a mass equal to about 4 million times the mass of the Sun. In fact, it is now generally thought that most spiral and elliptical galaxies contain a supermassive black hole at their centers. Although most of these supermassive black holes are similar in mass to the one at the center of the Milky Way, some galaxies harbor even larger black holes, with masses that are measured in the billions rather than millions of solar masses. Black holes are a consequence of Einstein's own theory of general relativity. And yet Einstein never came to accept that black holes did or even could exist in our universe. Within the next lecture, we'll talk about another prediction of general relativity. Like the existence of black holes, this prediction is also known to be true. And like with black holes, Einstein again resisted this prediction of his own theory, at least for a time. The prediction that I'm talking about is that of the ripples in the fabric of space and time, known as gravitational waves.